Coming to you from Toronto, Canada, this is Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to this show.
All right, coming to you from Toronto, Canada, and on link from Lethbridge, Alberta, the Classic Camera Revival.
Hello from out west.
Hello, John. How is it out there?
It's flat.
Oh, it's one place where you can have your dog run away and 3 days later be able to call it back.
Yeah, because you can still see it.
All right, so today's show is different since Alex is taking the month off and John is in beautiful Alberta. So we are recording via a Skype link. Today will be not just a little different. We'll also be discussing the wonderful Olympus systems, such as Donna's wonderful OM2N, and I'll be discussing the Olympus trip.
And I'll be discussing the Pen F.
Perfect. That actually sounds awesome. So today we'll start with the veteran and skilled portrait photographer, John. John, take it away.
Okay, and like I said, I'm going to be talking about the Olympus Pen F and the Olympus Pen system. And this is considered a classic by many, many people. And what is unique about this, it was introduced, the Olympus Pen F was introduced in 1963 as the first, and as it turned out, as far as I'm aware, the only 35mm half-frame SLR that was built from the ground up as half-frame. There are things like there's a Konica SLR, which could be converted to half-frame, but just with masking. This camera was built from the bottom up, from the ground up, as a half frame. And it has a lot of interesting features. First of all, you look at it and you think it's an SLR, but where's the hump? There is no hump because it doesn't use the traditional pentaprism. It uses a mirror system called a poroprism, which means you had like the through the lens viewing, because it's an SLR, but with no hump on top. So it gives it a very compact, almost a rangefinder look and feel. And it is a joy to shoot because it is so compact and light. Another thing that's interesting is the shutter. It uses a shutter that's actually not too different from the shutter on the old Universal Mercury 2. And one of the neat things about it is, unlike the traditional focal plane shutters of the time, which if you were lucky could only X-sync with an electronic flash up to like maybe 1/60th at the time, this will X-sync all the way up to its top shutter speed of 1/500th. So that is very, very uncommon on a camera that where the shutter was not built into the interchangeable lenses. Like, it's not a leaf shutter. It's quite interesting. Another interesting thing about this camera is the fact that because it's the half-frame format, the size of the image is 18 by 24. It's basically the same size as a traditional 35mm movie frame. If you look through the viewfinder, you will see that the default orientation is not landscape like any other SLR or rangefinder camera. It is actually portrait. And what I've found is that it gives a really different eye or look to the camera. You find yourself composing and in a different way, and seeing possibilities in pictures in different ways, just because the viewfinder defaults to a portrait orientation. Now, to get one of these cameras, this is a camera now that's the series is like 40 years old, so you're buying vintage gear. A couple of things to look out for. There are three models. There are actually four models, but you don't want to consider the fourth model at all. I'll get to that in a second. The original is the Pen F. The second is the Pen FT. There was one called the Pen FV, as in Victor, or very hard to find. And there's one that was made to be mounted onto microscopes, and you don't want that one because it has a circular viewfinder. It's really purpose-built. Now, you will see a lot of Pen FTs on eBay, for example. And what makes this model unique is that it has a built-in through-the-lens meter. However, the way they had to get it to work was that the viewfinder is partially silvered or partially transparent. So it's dimmer, basically about a stop dimmer than the Pan F. Also, it takes mercury batteries, which of course you don't find these days because they're illegal, and they should be because they're not environmentally friendly. So you'd have to figure out a way to use a replacement battery, like a hearing aid cell or something like that. And the last thing is that the metering system is cumbersome. It uses non-standard markings on the lens. It's not coupled. It's just a real pain in the ass. So my belief is that, with the exception of one warning I've read about, that the Pen F is the one to go with. And the one warning is there are people who say that the shutter on the Pen F can be occasionally erratic. I've not run into that with mine, but just a warning. Now, if you are lucky to find a Pen FV, this is the rarest of the models, but it sort of has the best of all worlds. It has a more reliable shutter, but it doesn't have the blankety-blank built-in exposure meter, so you don't have the dimmer viewfinder. I think it's the best model to get, but sadly, it is the rarest. I did a search on eBay, could not find any of them. Now, there's a wide range of lenses made for this camera, everything from a 20mm wide angle, and of course, because this is half-frame, you more or less have to double. So I guess it'd be equivalent to something like maybe a 35 or so. A 20 at the low end, up to, now get this, Mike, an 800mm f8 telephoto mirror lens.
Holy...
Yeah, exactly.
And that's half-frame.
And there's one beautiful lens. It's a 38mm f2.8 pancake lens. Super, super flat, makes the camera very compact. The bad news is that a lot of these lenses are like unobtainium. They are so rare to find. It's not hard to find the 38mm 1.8, which is the standard lens. There's a 50 to 90mm zoom lens, which on eBay goes for about $100. I may invest in one at some point. But also, because the body is so thin, you could adapt almost any major lens mount to this camera. And you can go on eBay and find adapters like to allow things like Canon lenses, Nikon lenses, which is what I do. So you can use other lens families with this. So in closing, this is an amazing camera. It feels beautiful, handles beautiful, and I can see why it's considered a classic.
Yeah, I'm just taking a quick look on wonderful eBay at the moment, just having a quick peek at them, and they are quite the lovely camera. Now, the one you have, is that the one with the beautiful script F, or is yours the more plain one that just kind of just says F?
The original Pen F is the one that has the Gothic F, so I have the original Pen F.
Oh, beautiful. Very nice. And when you're saying that the shutter, it's similar to the Mercury or the Universal Mercury 2, that would be a rotary shutter?
Correct. It's quite similar.
Okay, just making sure. All right, and it'll be me.
And you're talking about the Trip 35, right?
Yes, I'm talking about the wonderful and venerable Trip 35. Now, a lot of people know this camera. They know this camera as pretty much a cult camera. But unlike other cult cameras, because there were so many of these cameras made, I mean, we're talking over 10 million of these things were sold, it does not have cult camera pricing. In fact, pricing is actually relatively low. I mean, it's not unheard of for someone to pick one of these cameras up for even $10 to $20 on eBay. Now, whether that's still the price of them today, I'm not 100% sure, because we're talking about 2 years ago when I picked mine up. It was anywhere between $10 and $40. I found the only problem with these when you're buying one is sometimes it can be hit and miss because of the one major selling factor and also huge flaw with this camera is the selenium meter, mm-hmm. or I should say the selenium cell. Now, the problem with selenium cells is over time they lose sensitivity and eventually gets to the point where they just will not function. And that was the whole thing with the Trip 35, is it's based entirely around the selenium cell, which in all honesty, if you have a good one that's still working, you are laughing. The thing is like a little tank, and the lens is super tack sharp. So let's go with a little bit of history on it. From 1967, when the Trip 35 was introduced, it kept selling, and it kept selling for 17 years. So from 1967 all the way through to 1984, the Olympus Trip 35 was being sold. And the really neat thing is you can actually date your trip by the shutter release button. Up until 1978, it actually had a metal button. Anything beyond that, and it was just a black plastic button. Now, the one I have is metal, so I know that my model was built pre-1978. Now, the other thing with this camera is it has two shutter speeds. It has 1/40th of a second and 1/200th of a second. Plus, it automatically set the aperture that it figures will make an accurate exposure by whatever speed setting of your film that you've put in. Now, of course, it's not DX coded, but that's okay. A little quick flip of the ring at the front, and you can set your ASA speed from, I believe it's about 25 through to 400, which is a pretty good range. Now, the other thing about this camera is it's designed to use a zone focus or guesstimate focus system. Now, zone focus, it has the usual head, one person, two persons, and finally the mountains. Now, the one thing with this is if you look through the viewfinder and you look down to the bottom right, it'll tell you what part you're on, whether you're on head, whether you're on a one-person shot, two-person shot, group, or mountains. You can see that quite clearly where you are. Now, the other option you can do is you can guess the focus. So if you flip your camera upside down, you'll see that it's got feet and meter markings on the lens itself. And you can always set there and guess your focus range using that. Or if you put it just a headshot, so you want to do a little quick portrait, then you can set your distance there, and you can kind of get a better idea of how far the subject has to be. So something along those lines, I think it's actually really, really good. I like the way it's designed, but then again, I have a soft spot for zone focus cameras. Now, the other thing that it has is when you flip the aperture ring off of A, which is auto, as everybody knows it as, it now goes into its flash mode, which means that you set the aperture, you have your flash set on top because it does have a hot shoe on it. And using that, you figure out what your guide number is, you set your f-stop, set your distance, and you take your shot. And flash fires, and it'll fire at, I'm not sure, I can't remember what speed it is that the camera automatically sets the shutter speed to. I believe it's 1/40th of a second for when you're shooting on straight, just set your aperture so you're in flash mode. I believe it's just 1/40th of a second. Now, this camera is really compact. It can fit in your pocket. Usually, I put it in the pocket of my jacket just because it has slightly bigger pockets, plus they're a little bit better on padding. Or it'll easily fit in a woman's purse. And that was, I'm almost positive that's what this camera was basically designed around, was the woman puts it in her purse, she wants to take a shot, takes it out of her purse, takes a shot, puts it back. And there's a whole bunch of cameras that have been designed that way. But that'll definitely be for a future episode. The grip on it, it's a typical late 60s, early 70s camera. It's designed similar to a rangefinder. So it's got the rectangular box sort of shape to it. It's got the offset viewfinder. And it's basically designed to be similar to a rangefinder. So when you're holding it, you kind of get that feeling. And with the way that you can see the zones that you've set it to, it's almost like you're using a rangefinder without quite the accurate focusing of a rangefinder. The other thing that I really like about it is the winder on it. It's just a little wheel on the side that you can wind, as opposed to using an action lever, such as on many SLRs you have the action lever. Now, the other thing you'll notice about that wheel is it carried over onto the XA line of cameras. Some people like them, some people hate them, but I mean, if you consider that it's on one-time use cameras today, it was one of the systems that really caught on quite nicely as a easy-to-use manual advance.
This camera sounds like it would be ideal for street photography.
And you know what? It really is. You can just pick it up, quickly compose, take the shot. And you know what? The shutter is near on silent. You can't hear it. There's no mirror to slap. There's no sitting there fiddling with the focus. You can pretty much set it to a group shot and kind of compose it as you see as it goes and just quickly up to your eye, take the shot, and down it goes, and there you go. And I think that next camera I take out for a street shoot, definitely going to be the Trip 35. And I believe there was, Missy. I believe we went on a photo walk when we went down to the Vivian Meyer exhibit. Missy was there with her Trip 35, and she was quite literally, I remember watching her do it. She would take it up, point at someone, quickly shoot it, and back down it went. And that, of course, was when she wasn't shooting with her Leica. But that's going a little bit off topic here.
Another point you made that I think bears repeating and reinforcing is the quality of the Olympus lenses in general, whether it's on a Trip or Pan-F or the OM series or the XA that you referred to. I don't think I've ever seen a bad Olympus lens.
No, I definitely agree. It is fantastic. Now, this camera, for those that do follow it, it was reviewed by Ken Rockwell, and he really liked this camera. And the lens on it, it's a 40mm f2.8 Zuiko non-interchangeable lens, and it's four elements in three groups, which is kind of like a Tesser model. So, I mean, everybody that's ever used Tesser lenses knows they are excellent. And let's see, there's just one thing I'm quickly reading here about Ken Rockwell is when he did it, he actually tested it up against the Canon 1740 F4L lens. And he found that even this Zuiko lens was actually sharp in the corners. It actually beat out the Canon L lens, which, honestly, that's pretty impressive.
And I've seen photos online of example shots from Trip 35, and they're always tack sharp.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with it. Every single shot I've done with this, to be perfectly honest, I don't think I've ever had a bad shot. It's really, really simple to focus. It really surprised me. And it's really, really, just the way it's designed, the way the markings are, gives you just fantastic, simple focusing. And it's surprising. I mean, I've held some zone focus cameras or scale focus cameras where you have to sit there and you set the distance on it. And I have missed focus. This one here, I honestly don't think I've really ever missed a focus shot on it. I'm really impressed. Now, that could also be a testament to the camera stopping down the aperture properly to a point where it's going to be within relative focus, that just looking at a scan or looking at a quick 4x6 or 8x10 print, I'm not going to notice too much. But just average looking at it through a scan, no, it's pretty simple to focus this camera, which I'm really impressed with.
So I think so far we're 2 for 2 on highly recommended Olympus cameras. Time to go 3 for 3.
All right. And so for that, I'll pass over the microphone to Donna.
Today I'll be talking about the Olympus OM-2N. The Olympus OM-2N was introduced in 1975. It is a single-lens reflex film system camera that was produced by Olympus of Japan. Now, the Olympus OM-2N is an aperture priority automatic exposure camera. It has full manual operation with slight move of a switch. The OM-2N is very light. It's a sturdy camera with the same body style as the manual OM-1 with a new automatic exposure system. One of the biggest selling points of the OM-2N was that the OM-1 accessories and lenses would fit without any kind of modification, which offers a complete photographic system which could be carried around easily and allowing the OM-1 users an easy upgrade, which is pretty neat. Although the camera was produced in magazines as a new superior camera, Olympus as a company did not have the same recognition as Nikon or Canon. As a result of that, some of the professionals considered the cameras inferior due to their lighter weight. The most commonly advertised feature of the camera was that it was the first camera to offer a TTL direct metering system for film that was named ADM, which is also known as the auto dynamic metering. This metering was the first ever to come out on the market. I really would recommend this camera. It's a very classy camera. It's very nice grip, very easy to hold. Again, it being an Olympus, it's very small, compact, which is also, again, good for a woman with her purse. I think if you're looking for your first camera and you don't know what camera to get, I really highly recommend the OM2N. I really don't think that you'd be disappointed.
I'm going to throw in one little piece of trivia here.
Okay.
And that is that the designer of the Olympus OM1, OM2 series, a guy named Matani, I probably mispronounced that, is the same guy who designed the Olympus Pen F that we were discussing earlier.
Oh, really?
And I believe he also did the Olympus XA, so genius at work.
Huh, that's pretty neat.
And would you say that the Olympus OM2N feels nice in the hands?
It does. It feels really nice. And I like the fact, because I have small hands for myself, so it being small, it's easier for me to use. I really like it.
And of course, it uses those lovely Zuiko lenses, so you really can't go wrong.
That's right. That's right. And the fact that you can use the OM1 lenses without any kind of adjustments, that's a really pretty cool feature to have.
And I'd say it's probably, I'd recommend it over the OM1 because I believe that the OM1 is another one of those cameras that uses the mercury cells.
That's correct. Yes, it does.
So I think we have 3 for 3 on Mount Olympus.
The only thing I will quickly add about the OM2 is one minor flaw that I've noticed with it, but I also noted this with the OM2 SP, was that it really eats batteries. So when not in use...
Yes, that is true. I forgot about that. That is the only side effect that I will agree on. It really goes through your batteries pretty quickly.
So when not in use, remember, take your batteries out. They'll last just that little bit longer.
Okay, now the next segment of the show, we're going to talk about some of our favorite films. And we're not talking things like Tri-X or T-Max 100 or Delta 400 or anything that's fairly commonplace. We're going a little bit obscure, a little bit specialized.
And the weird stuff.
The weird stuff. And if anyone tells you, hey, film is dead, well, there are so many weird, air quotes, weird stuff types of film you can get that I'd say, no way, film is not dead.
We've had to do a little bit of time warping for this episode since Alex was not available, but he has joined us through the miracle of recording at different times, and he's going to talk about Eastman 5363.
Hey, thanks, John, and hey, guys, how's it all going? So Eastman 5363 is a high-contrast motion picture title film that comes from our good friends in Rochester, Eastman Kodak, and I was sent this role initially by the Film Photography Podcast with the idea that, hey, look, we know nothing on how to develop this stuff outside of these proprietary Kodak motion picture developers. What can we do with it? So I immediately latched onto this because it's like, hey, this is cool. I actually get to come up with ideas and experiment, and I love doing that. So the first thing I thought, all right, this is a high-contrast motion picture film, and the only one I'd really had experience with before was SO-331. So working with that, I shot my first roll at ASA 50 and developed it in X-TEL 1:1 and found out it was horribly, horribly, horribly underdeveloped. So I thought, you know what? Let's try a completely different tract. The next one, the next developer I used was HC110 Dilution G, and this one, Leslie, was the initial one to do it for, and it came out beautifully. But of course, I wanted to do more. So I tried stand developing it in Rodinal 1:200 for 2 hours and completely and totally overdeveloped it. So probably would need to lessen the dilution to maybe 1:100 for an hour or so or 30 minutes to really bring it back. And then I discovered, why don't I try using PMK Pyro? And I had about 4 rolls of this stuff left. So I had a lot of play to practice it, and I ended up settling on the 11-minute mark with the standard 1:2:100 for PMK Pyro. Now, this film is definitely a high-contrast film, but it produces an absolutely wonderful, chromey feel to it if you do it in the dilution G of HT110 or the PMK Pyro for 11 minutes. And, I mean, it just gives just a really surreal look, something you don't get with other black and white films. You shoot it at, it has a really wide range. I've seen it shot from anywhere from 50 all the way down to 12. I've really settled on 25 for this film. And again, if you want something really unique, something completely different than what you're used to, Eastman 5363, you can get it through the Film Photography Project. It's about $6 American a roll, which really isn't bad.
So a couple questions for you. You noted that it's basically meant to be, you know, a very high contrast stock. It makes sense if it's for titling.
Exactly.
In the dilutions that and developers you mentioned, does it stay extremely high contrast, or can you get it to something approaching continuous tone?
The HC110 dilution G and the PMK Pyro really does bring those midtones back, but it still gives that high contrast chrome look to it. Definitely. Highlight detail gets lost as well if you shoot for the shadows. So it's really one where you want to put it in a camera with a good matrix metering system. I've shot it with the Nikon F4 and the Contax G2, and I actually really prefer it in the F4 with the meter it has.
And one more question. Does this film have an anti-halation layer?
I believe it does, but don't quote me on that. I'm not sure. It is a motion picture film, so...
The reason I ask, I know there's some other films like SO331, which does not have an anti-halation backing, and you can get some rather interesting glowing effects.
Yeah, this doesn't have a glow, so yeah, it definitely has an anti-halation layer then.
Okay, thanks, Alex.
Hey, enjoy the rest of the show.
Now we're back in the present. So next up is Mike, and Mike is going to talk about one of his favorite films, Polypan F. Take it away, Mike.
Thanks, John. Okay, for those of you that have no idea about Polypan F, or you've seen small little clippings here and there, or you just kind of glanced at it on eBay, or you've heard them talking about it on the Film Photography Podcast. Well, I go back actually as the first black and white film I have ever shot, which is Polypan F. Now, most people, when they shoot their first black and white film, it's either Ilford Delta or HP5 or Kodak Tri-X or even the chromogenic ones such as BW400CN or XP2. No, I had to pick one of the most obscure films, and I had no idea how this film's even going to react. So I just said, why not? I bought a whole bunch of it, loaded it in my camera, went out and shot it. And as soon as I shot it, oh my God, seeing the images I got in it, I fell in love. And the fact that this thing does not have an anti-halation layer on it makes it that much better. I mean, it's not the most fine-grained film. It's actually, considering that it's a 50-speed film, it's actually considerably grainy for such a slow speed. But I find that gives it its really unique quality. Because the grain, it's a classic grain. It's not T grain, it's not delta grain. It's just beautiful crystals. I really, really like the way it's designed. Now, the sad part is that it's no longer manufactured. And myself, as well as a couple other people, have the very last batch of it. And unfortunately, no, I'm not sharing it's just too precious to me to share, but I have shared it in the past. And a lot of people that have shot it, they know where I'm coming from when I tell you how wonderful this film is. Now, the one thing I've never done to this film is reverse it. And I have heard that it is fantastic for reversal. Now, I've done pretty much everything with this film. I mean, I've shot it at 1.5 all the way up to 1600. And I'm not the only person that's gone up and tried 1600. And everybody that's tried it has failed. The film will not get there. But the fact that you actually will get an image out of it is pretty impressive considering how slow this film is. I mean, 1600 from a 50 speed film, that's impressive.
I'm going to jump in for a second and say that I once shot a roll at 400 because I thought my camera was loaded with Tri-X. And at 400, I was able to save the film.
Yeah, that's been one thing about this film is whether you're shooting it at 25 or at 400, it's usable. And you know what I noticed? And I don't know if you did. Even at 400, the grain was not bad considering that that's a three-stop push. And I find Tri-X on a three-stop push, it gets really grainy.
It can, yeah. I noticed that the shadow detail also hung around to some degree at 400.
It did. I actually remember those shots. You had done a blog post on it.
Yeah, when I developed the film, Mike, as soon as I took it out of the camera, it was a shoot with a model downtown.
Yeah.
And, you know, I took the film out of the camera, realized that it was polypan F, it was not Tri-X. So after muttering some technical terminology, shall we say, that I won't repeat here, I did a bit of research. I think I consulted you, and I ended up using HC110. I'd have to look up what I did. I probably, if I were to do it again, I probably might give it a touch more development, but the pictures worked. It was not a failure. So it is a very versatile film.
Oh, yeah. Now, one thing I've noticed with it, I don't know if I'm the only one, is the glow you get. Now, we're not talking about highlights kind of having a little bit of a shimmer around them. We're talking about highlights that seem to bleed everywhere, which is, I guess, where you get the idea of a glow, which is actually because this film does not have an anti-halation layer on it. So the light, when it goes through the film, it hits the backing plate and it actually reflects and causes a base, almost like a bloom of light from it. Now, the one thing I've done that has actually accentuated this was give it a 1/3 stop overexposure and using it on a shiny pressure plate, like a silvered pressure plate, which I have in my Kodak Signet. So giving it that little bit of extra overexposure plus the shiny backing plate, and it just goes just wild. I'll definitely link a photo on the show notes, which really, really accentuates the amount of glow that I've kind of called aura, because when you see the image, you'll understand why I call it aura.
Now, Mike, you had mentioned processing this film as reversal, which means as a slide or direct positive. What kind of process will you be using to do that?
Well, myself personally, I've never done it. I know that you can send it out to places such as DR5, which specializes in reversal, or you can mix up your own kit using potassium permanganate and sulfuric acid. But a friend of mine in Portland, I believe it's Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine, which it's completely opposite coasts. He developed a system for doing reversals using household chemicals. And we're not talking about harsh chemicals. I mean, one of them you can pour on an open wound to help clean it. I mean, we're talking hydrogen peroxide. And the other one, if you pour it on said open wound, you'd probably scream and curse and want to throw things or have some really violent curses coming out of your mouth. And we're not talking about alcohol. We're talking about vinegar. That's not something you want to get on a cut. So what he did was he took in, let's say, a container, I don't know, a stainless steel tank. Standard size of it is 250 mil or 225 mil. Well, what he did was he took 250 milliliters of hydrogen peroxide, 3%, and he added, was it 3 tablespoons of vinegar. He brought the temperature up to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or was it only 60 degrees Fahrenheit? I'm going to double check that, and I'll have it in the show notes of the exact temperature. And what you do first is you develop it in whatever developer you want, such as HC-110 or T-Max or Rodinal, whatever the case may be that you wanted to use to develop it. You develop it as normal. Then you pull out the developer, stop it using this acid bath, as you would figure it would be. And what that does is the hydrogen peroxide bath with the vinegar, you'd pour that in and you'd go for about 6 to 7 minutes with that. Then after that, you dump it. Now, this is the part that is the reversing part, is you take the film out of the canister. And at this point, all the developed silver that was on the film is gone. And I believe that's actually because of the hydrogen peroxide. If I remember correct, someone had told me that I can take old used fixer, pour some hydrogen peroxide in, and it causes all the silver to condense. I haven't tried it, but since I have heard that, I can't remember who told me, maybe that is what causes it all to be stripped from the film. But of course, the undeveloped silver is still there. And this is why you have to take it out of the container. You then fog it to light, and you make sure you get the whole film strip fogged to light. And at this point, you can develop in the light. Well, now you just take that same film that you just fogged and develop it in whatever developer you want. I mean, you can even use Dektol, because at this point in time, it makes no difference. It's just going to be a rapid develop, gets it all done, and then right then and there, you are now left with absolutely beautiful slides. And here's the really neat thing is he showed me some scans he did of the PolyPan that he did as a slide, and they are spectacular. Now, I'm just going to get permission from him, which he's already told me that it's not a problem. I can do it because I believe I have linked it on a blog. I'll get some photos that he did, and I will link them on our site, on our show notes, and make sure that he gets full credit for it, because his work, it's nice. It really is. But the images he took was just straight out as a test shot. So we're not talking anything spectacular, but the fact he wanted to prove it worked. And lo and behold, one of the first films he tried as reversal for black and white, PolyPan. My first film as black and white, PolyPan. That's got to say something about this stuff. It's somebody's first somewhere.
One thing I'll add is I still have quite a bit of PolyPan. I still have over 100 feet of it in, yep, in a bulk roll. So what I will do, because I'm a generous guy, is as part of a little show promotion, the first person who listens to the show and sends me an email, J.G. Meadows, M-E-A-D-O-W-S, @gmail.com, I will send you a roll of PolyPan.
Oh, well, that's awfully kind. Wow, really nice.
But you have to be quick. And sorry, Mike, as a host of the show, you are disqualified.
Shucks. That's all right. I'll survive. I've still got a fair bit. And I really think that giving someone the chance to shoot a roll of PolyPan, they're not going to be disappointed. With the roll, they'll be disappointed after when they can't get any more.
Well, thanks, Mike. And so now it's my turn, and I'm going to talk about one of my favorite films. And this is Raleigh Retro 80S film. It's available in 35mm and 120 medium format. I really wish it was available in 4x5, but I guess I just take what I can get. And this film is really neat for a number of reasons. There are a couple of downsides to it you have to be very careful with, but it's an amazing film. It's speed of ISO 80. It has extended red sensitivity. So in addition to shooting it as a regular, like a regular film, if you put a red filter on, you'll get very exaggerated red filter effects, as you'd expect. And you can also shoot it as infrared. So if you put on an IR-72 filter and expose it roughly around exposure index 3 to 6 in that general area, you get very, very satisfactory infrared results. One thing you do have to be careful with is the strength of the IR filter that you use. Mike, you remember when we went to the McMichael Gallery up in Kleinberg the one time?
Absolutely.
And I was shooting this stuff in IR, and I have a bunch of IR filters, and I finally figured out why I got a blank roll when I developed. I was using an IR 920. Up in that range, the Retro ADS is blind. But if you use an IR-72, which is the most common IR filter, you will get very, very nice IR results. And so that makes the film very, very versatile. You don't have to buy a specialized IR film to do infrared film. Also, the film is on a polyester base. So it, on one hand, it dries extremely flat. It dries quickly. It is a joy to scan. But because the base is so thin, it is susceptible to light piping on the first couple of shots in a roll. So you want to load it carefully. Really want to be in subdued. You don't have to load it in complete darkness like a true IR film. But you want to be in as subdued light as possible. And what I'd say, the first couple of shots on the roll, don't use them for anything important. You can get the possibility of light piping. The other issue with this film is it's very, very high grain. It's very, very fine grain. It's amazingly fine grain. It actually makes a great film to use in my Olympus Pen F that I mentioned earlier because, you know, the negative's smaller, and so you don't get a grainy image. But the one trick with this film, it is inherently quite high contrast. It's hard to get non-blocked highlights and shadow detail at the same time. There are things you can do, like, for example, you might recommend using Rodinal at a high dilution as a compensating developer. And so that's my standard process now is I develop it in Rodinal or one of the different named equivalents. One part Rodinal to 50 parts water at 68 Fahrenheit, 20 Celsius for 14 minutes. And that does a pretty decent job of preserving whatever shadow detail you can, and because it's a very fine-grained film to begin with, Rodinal is not a fine-grained developer, but it's not an issue here. What I've also tried in the past with this film, and I should experiment again in the future, is using D23, which you can't buy, you have to make it, but it's a very, very simple developer, only has two ingredients, and it's an inherently low-contrast developer. It's actually D76 without ingredient in D76 that energizes the developer a bit more. And so I'm going to do some more experimentation with that. Now, you can use the high contrast nature of the film to your advantage. We've all had the experience of getting all set. We're looking forward to going out on the weekend to shoot, and it is overcast. It is so dull, dull, dull. I have found this film is my go-to film for dull days. I shot it in my recent trip to Scotland, and let me tell you, it rains in Scotland, and you shoot an overcast, dull day with this film, and the silver just comes alive. So I wouldn't use this film at the beach, but on a rainy, rainy day, this is well worth checking out. And the great thing is this film is still made, available at a number of different sources. Where I found it, if you're in Canada, if you go to argentex.ca, you can get it there in 35mm, 120, and bulk rolls as well. And I buy this stuff in bulk. Highly recommended.
Oh, yeah. I definitely second that. And I've actually used it for portraits. One of the portraits I did was my sister's kids. And the one thing I thought was absolutely amazing about this for portraits, especially in a studio setting, it gives the classic black and white look. Mm-hmm. It is just absolutely stunning. I was floored. And as you were mentioning about the fine grain, when it comes to using Rodinal, a lot of people don't recognize fine grain and Rodinal, but I remember those shots that you posted in your Pen F, and even those were hard to see the grain. And that, with a half frame, the fact that he was pretty, pretty small and almost fine-grained on a half frame, it was just stunning. And the nice thing about Rodinal, it doesn't dissolve grain, so you always get a sharp image, even if your shot wasn't.
If you like sharpness, you'll like this film. And you also raise a good point about the portrait photography, especially if you throw a yellow filter on this and do portrait work, it's magical.
I haven't tried yellow in portraits with that film. I have used yellow when just shooting landscapes, and it was a really, really nice effect. And then I also used a deep red filter, which I thought was nice, but R72, I was floored. Like, I had heard that you could do IR with it, and then I had to try it, and I was amazed. So I'll have to give it a try with throwing a yellow on and doing some portraits. That actually sounds like a really, really fun thing to do.
So there you have it. Three, air quotes, obscure films that are still, well, at least two out of the three are readily available. And there are countless other interesting films that we've discussed, or we didn't discuss, that we could have mentioned. So film dead? Not in a million years.
Nope, not in my book. It's still alive and it's still going strong.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the show. Next month, I think we'll start getting back to normal with all of us back in the same place, same time. But in the meantime, this is John and Mike and Donna saying, have fun, keep shooting.
Keep those shutters firing.
Keep that film rolling.
We'd love to hear from you. You can check us out on Facebook, look for Classic Camera Revival, or send us an email, classiccamerarevival@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.